Islam and the World by Sheikh Abul Hassan Ali Nadwi. 5. Muslim Decadence. A certain writer has remarked that there are two happenings in human life, the exact time of which one can never tell. One is related to the individual and the other to collective existence. One is the coming of sleep and the other is the decline or fall of a nation. One cannot exactly tell when a person passes from wakefulness to sleep, nor at the time in which a nation begins to decline. With the Islamic Empire, however, it was difficult. If we have to draw a line between its ascent and decline, we can do it easily. The time between the Khulafa'i Rashidun, that is the rightly guided Khalifas, and the emergence of Arab imperialism. The Caliphate was primarily a religious institution, and its political character was subsidiary. The Caliphate retained its spiritual orientation during the regime of the first four Khalifas, because the men who then guided its destiny were that may be described as living miracles of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. They were the true specimens of comprehensiveness of faith. They were ascetics, imams, preachers, judges, lawgivers, chancellors of the exchequer, generals, administrators, and statesmen. On this account, all power in the empire, spiritual and temporal, was vested in one man, the Khalifa, who surrounded himself with a body of advisors, molded and modeled by the same master craftsmen who had trained the Khalifa. The Khalifa acted in consultation with his advisors, and the spirit of this ideal pupils of the Prophet pervaded the entire life of the Millah, that is the Ummah, leaving no room for a clash between spiritual and temporal spheres of its activity. Jihad and Ijtihad. There being no separate realms of God and Caesar and Islam, the Muslim Caliphate or the Imama calls for a large variety of human qualities. A Khalifa or the Imam should, in addition to possessing a high degree of personal virtue, be keenly alive to the needs of Jihad and Ijtihad. Jihad, in Islamic terminology, means to strive to one's utmost for what is the most noble object on earth. There can be nothing more noble for a Muslim than earning God's pleasure through complete submission to God's will. For this, a long and sustained inner struggle is required against the false deities that may claim to his spiritual allegiance, as well as against all those whims and desires that may try to lure him away from the fold of God, goodness and piety. When this has been attained and it becomes its moral responsibility to exert himself for the improvement of his fellow beings and the establishment of divine sovereignty over the world around him, it is a privilege as well as a necessity, for it often becomes impossible to remain true to God, even in one's individual capacity, in an ungodly environment. This latter circumstance has been described in the Quran as fitna, meaning calamity, treachery, sin, temptation, and seduction. It is true that everything that exists in this world, animals, plants, minerals, bow to the sovereignty of God and is subservient to God's will. Says the Holy Quran in Surah Al-Imran, while all creatures in the heavens and on earth have willingly or unwillingly bowed to his will, have accepted Islam, and to him shall they return. As is also mentioned in Surah Al-Hajj, see you not that to God bow and worship all things that are in the heavens and the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, the hills, the trees, the animals, and a great number among mankind. But a great number are also such as are fit for punishment. But this has nothing to do with human endeavor. All created things are subject to the unfailing laws of nature. They, in due course, pass through the different phases of birth, growth, and decay that has been ordained for them. The law for the enforcement of which Muslims are required to strive is the one which was brought into the world by the prophets. Opposition to this law will not cease as long as the world goes on. There will always be some force or other to resist or to reject it. Jihad is therefore an eternal phase of human life. It may take various forms, one of which is war, which may sometimes be the highest form to take, the object of which is to crush the forces of evil, which pull it in the direction of unbelief, and involve people in highly hazardous spiritual tussle of having to choose between the truth and untruth. Says the Holy Quran in Surah Baqarah, and fight them on until there is no more tumult or oppression, and there prevail justice and faith in God. It is essential for those who are involved in jihad to be well versed not only in the teachings and practices of Islam, but also in the philosophy and the ways of unbelief, so that they may be able to recognize unbelief in whatever disguise it may manifest itself. It was said by Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, I'm afraid he who has been brought up in Islam and has no knowledge of Jahiliyyah, that is un-Islamic culture and philosophy, may become an instrument disintegrating Islam unknowingly. It is, however, not possible for every Muslim to acquire an intimate understanding of the ways of Jahiliyyah. However, he who directs and controls the affairs of the Islamic State should be better informed in this respect. The Muslim leader should always be able to build up strength to the best of their capacity and to hold themselves constantly in readiness to meet the challenges of the enemies and the enemies of faith. It is a command of God, as the Holy Quran says in Surah Al-Anfal, against them make ready your strength to the utmost of your power, including the steeds of war, to strike terror into the hearts of the enemies of God and your enemies and others besides them, whom you may not know, but whom God does know. Whatever you shall spend in the cause of God shall be repaid unto you, and you shall not be treated unjustly. Ijtihad means the ability to cope with the ever-changing pattern of life requirements. It calls for a deep insight into the soul of Islam and a thorough knowledge of the basic principles of Islamic jurisprudence. It also includes the ability to use the treasures of nature in the service of Islam instead of letting them fall in the hands of the unbelieving materialists who use them for spreading arrogance and mischief in the world. The Umayyads and the Abbasid Empires. Unfortunately, the ones who succeeded to the caliphate after the first four khalifas were greatly lacking in these qualities. They did not have the moral or spiritual caliber one would expect from Muslim leadership. They were not able to wear down the pagan attitudes and habits of their race. None of the Umayyad or the Abbasid khalifas were, in solitary exception of Umar bin Abdulaziz, came fully up to the standards of Islam. The evils of monarchy. As a result, there soon occurred a rift between the church and state in this religio-political order of Islam. The Khalifa, not being proficient or interested enough in religion, addressed themselves solely to political and administrative matters and disregarded their religious duties. When a religious need arose, they turned to the ulama, that is, the scholars, for advice, but accepted only that which suited their purpose. Thus, secular activity became independent of religion. The ulama, the scholars, except those few who succumbed to worldly advantage gained by joining the imperial court, arrayed themselves against it and initiated revolts within the empire from time to time. But they quietly withdrew into religious establishments and devoted their energies to individual improvement and reforms. As the hold of religion weakened, the standard in morality also deteriorated rapidly amongst the Muslims. To persevere, influences of the demoralized attitude of the Khalifas, who were far from being models of Islamic morality, was inevitably to adversely affect the moral structure of society as a whole. The Quranic injunction regarding the rejoining of the right and the forbidding of the wrong ceased to have any meaning in practice, since it did not enjoy the backing of the state, and the vigilance of religion having ended, the un-Islamic tendencies began to affect the followers of Islam, ruining the rugged simplicity of their faith. The Muslims settled down to a life of ease and pleasure. They became lazy and self-indulgent. In such circumstances, it was futile to expect that they would discharge their duties as true followers of the Prophet and carry forward the message that he bequeathed to them. The fine impression that Islam had made on non-Muslims during the earlier days was nullified owing to the moral denigration of its followers. The non-Muslim naturally attributed the failings of Islam to their faith, and failings of Muslims to their faith, sorry. They lost confidence in Islam. A European writer remarked correctly that the decline of Islam began when people started to lose faith in the sincerity of its representatives. Philosophical mind games. From the natural sciences, Muslim thinkers drifted towards metaphysics and the theology of the Greeks, which was in fact merely a revised version of their mythology. The Greeks had ingeniously imparted a scholastic look to their mythology by dressing it up in philosophical garb. Their philosophy was purely speculative. The spirit of the Quran, on the other hand, is anti-classical. The Muslims, in fact, had no need to enter into theoretical disputes regarding the being and the attributes of God after the concrete knowledge of the Quran had placed in their hands. But they did not appreciate its worth, and instead of concentrating on solid spiritual and material welfare, that would have paved the way for universal expansion of Islam, they wasted their energies in profitless metaphysical discussions. Religious innovations. Thus, pagan beliefs and practices infiltrated into Muslim society. The superiority of the Muslims had over others flowed solely from their religion, and the secrets of the greatness of their religion lie in it being the revealed law. This law is the creation of God, and says the Holy Quran, such is the artistry of God who disposes all things in perfect order. If this divine law became polluted with human intervention, it will cease to be that it should be, a guarantee of success in this world and the next. Neither the human intellect will submit to it, nor will the mind of man be won over. Revival and restoration. So far, however, the basic values of religion remained intact and free from distortion. They remained absolutely free from all kinds of innovations, misconstructions, suppression. Islam did not close its eyes to the lapse of its followers. It was always on the alert, correcting, amending, admonishing. The Quran and the Sunnah were continually there, intact and unpolluted, to guide and to judge on occasions of doubt. They kept alive the spirit of defiance against the ruling classes, against other un-Islamic influences. The whole course of Islamic history is alight with crusading endeavors of consciousness, determined, brave-hearted men, who, like the true successors of the Prophet, faced the challenges of the time and restored, revived, and kept on moving the Ummah by restoring to Jihad and to Ijtihad. These two principles, which embody the dynamism of Islam, never cause a vacuum in its structure. They remained always active in the body of Islam as living factors, holding aloft the torch of religious endeavors in the midst of severest temptations. Thus, it was that darkness that was never allowed to spread over the whole world of Islam. Similarly, at every critical turn of history, some mighty man of action, some inspired defender of the faith, invariably burst upon the scene to beat off whatever threatened the existence of the Millah. Two of such outstanding personalities, produced by the undying spirit of Islam to defend itself, were Nuruddin Zangi and Salahuddin Ayyubi. The Crusades and the Zangi dynasty. Europe had been harboring evil design against the followers of Islam ever since it annexed the eastern wing of the European Empire including all the Christian holy places. But as the Muslims were then strong enough to defy all incursions, the Christian nations of Europe could not bring themselves to challenge them. Towards the end of the 11th century, however, the situation underwent a change, and great armies of crusaders were organized all over the European subcontinent to attack the Muslim countries of Palestine and Syria. The crusaders regained possession of Jerusalem in 1099 AD and took over the greater part of Palestine. Describing their invasion, Stanley Lane Poole says, "The crusaders penetrated like a wedge between the old wood and the new, and for a while seemed to have cleaved the trunk of the Muslim empire into splinters." Of the unspeakable cruelties perpetrated on the helpless Muslims by the Christians on their entry into Jerusalem, one of the Christian historian writes, "So terrible, it is said, was the carnage which followed that the horses of the crusaders who rode up to the mosque of Omar were knee-deep in the streams of blood. Infants were seized by their feet and dashed against the walls and whirled over battlements, while the Jews were burnt alive in the synagogues." The conquest of Jerusalem by the Christians was a momentous event. It exposed the rot that had started in the lands of Islam. Besides that, it announced the awakening of Europe after the Dark Ages, which had followed the decline of Europe, of Rome. It threw the entire Muslim world into jeopardy. The spirit of the Christians rose so high that in that time, Reginald, the master of crack, began to dream laying his hands on the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. The most calamitous hour in the history of Islam since the tragedy of apostasy was at hand. However, at that moment, then rose and from unexpected quarters a new star on the horizon of Islam. This was the Zangi dynasty of Mosul. Two members of which, Imamuddin Zangi and Nuruddin Zangi, repeatedly defeated the crusaders and drove them out almost of every town in Palestine except for Jerusalem. Nuruddin holds a high place in the history of Islam for his administrative merit, his piety, humility, justice, and the zest for jihad. A contemporary chronicler, while speaking of Nuruddin at that time, observes, "I have studied the lives of all the former sultans. I can say that, but for the first four rightly guided khalifas and Umar bin Abdul Aziz, none among them was more religious, just, and clement as Nuruddin Zangi." When Nuruddin died, Salahuddin became the spearhead of the Muslim resistance. Fighting battle after battle, he inflicted a crushing defeat on the crusaders at Hippin, Palestine, on the 4th of July, 1187. The hopes of the Christians were dashed to the ground and their armies were so totally demoralized. A single Saracen was seen dragging some 30 Christians he had taken prisoners and tied together with ropes. The dead lay in heaps like stones upon stones among broken crosses, severed hands and feet, while mutilated heads strewed the ground like a plentiful crop of lemons. Salahuddin then proceeded to retake Jerusalem. The fire that had been blazing in the breasts of the Muslims since the city had fallen into the hands of the Christians was at last quenched. Qadi ibn Shaddad, an intimate friend and counselor of Salahuddin Ayyubi, described the stirring spectacle of the victory of Jerusalem in the following words. "On all sides, prayers were being offered. From all sides, the cries of Allahu Akbar could be heard. After 90 years, the Jummah prayers were offered in Jerusalem. The cross which the Christian soldiers had mounted on the Dome of Rock was pulled down, and it was a wonderful spectacle. The grace of Almighty and the triumph of Islam were visible everywhere." The generosity, magnanimity, and the high sense of Islamic morality which Salahuddin displayed in that hour of triumph have been universally applauded by the historians. Says Stanley Lane Poole, "If the taking of Jerusalem were the only fact known about Salahuddin, it were enough to prove him the most chivalrous and the most great-hearted conqueror of his own and perhaps of any age." Europe was furious at these reverses. In desperation, crusaders from every European country converged on Syria and another series of bitter battles had started between the Christians and the Muslims. Once again, Salahuddin stood gallantly against the storm of concentrated Christian fury. After 5 years of relentless battle, a truce was signed at Ramallah in 1192 AD. The Muslims retained Jerusalem and all other towns and the fortresses they had captured, while the Christians only reigned over a small state of Acre. Thus, at last, the task which Salahuddin had set himself, or rather the mission that God had charged him with, was accomplished. Lane Poole observes, "The holy war was over, 5 years' contest ended. Before the great victory of Hittin in July 1187, not an inch of Palestine west of Jordan was in the Muslims' hands. After the peace of Ramallah in September, the whole land was theirs except for a narrow strip of the coast from Tyre to Jaffa. Salahuddin had no cause to be ashamed of this treaty." Salahuddin was a man of extraordinary ability and energy. His capacity for organization and leadership was astounding. After hundreds of years, he had succeeded in uniting the various nations and tribes amongst the Muslims under the banner of jihad by making them forget their feuds and jealousies for the sake of Islam. All the strength of Christendom concentrated in the Third Crusade had not shaken Salahuddin's power. His soldiers may have murmured at the long months of hard and perilous service year after year, but they never refused to come to his sermons and lay down their lives for his cause. Kurds, Turks, Arabs, Egyptians, they were all Muslims and his servants when he called them. In spite of their differences of race, their national jealousies and tribal pride, he had kept them together as one nation, not without difficulty, twice or thrice at a critical waver. The death of Salahuddin Ayyubi. Salahuddin, the faithful son of Islam, passed away on the 4th of March, 1193 AD. His selfless crusading spirit had made the Muslim world safe from the tyranny of the West for a long time to come, but the Christians had derived immense benefit from these wars, and they busied themselves at once in preparing for a new assault. Their turn came in the 19th century. The Muslims, however, wavered again and allowed the ground to slip under their feet. They began to fight amongst themselves. Unfortunately, they were no longer blessed with the leadership, possessing the eye and purpose, glowing enthusiasm, and the unflinching sincerity of Salahuddin Ayyubi. The Muslims, still an obstacle in the path of ignorance. Even with all their failings, the Muslims were nearer to the path of the prophets than any other people. For this reason, whatever of their former power and prestige was left continued to serve as a deterrent to ignorance. They were still a force in this world, commanding respect from near and far, but internally they were steadily declining. This fact could not be concealed for a very long time from the outside world. The facade of their strength was finally broken towards the middle of the 13th century, when they were attacked by wave after wave of savage nations, hostile powers, and Muslim lands fell into the hands of their enemies. The Tartar invasion. The fiercest among the barbarian invaders were the Tartars. They emerged from their homelands and spread like locusts over the Islamic world. It was a dreadful calamity which left the Muslims breathless with fear and frustration. Ibn Athir says, in the following words, "This disaster was so terrible that for long I could not decide whether to mention it or not. Even now it is with extreme reluctance that I do so. Who indeed can have the heart to relate the tragedy of the death of Islam and the followers of Islam, or the story of its humiliation and disgrace? Would that I had been born, that I were dead and forgotten before this catastrophe occurred, but friends prevailed upon me to write about this. I too thought that no useful purpose would be served by ignoring this tragedy. It's a disaster without parallel in history. It affects the entire human race in general and the Muslims in particular. If anyone were to claim that there have been another event like it from the time of Adam to this day, it would be incorrect, for history cannot produce a single instance that could be compared with it, nor perhaps will anything like it happen again till Judgment Day. The savages took pity on none. They slaughtered men, women, and children ruthlessly. They ripped the abdomens of pregnant women and killed the children in their wombs. To God we belong, and to Him we shall return. There is no fear or power but with God. It was the world-consuming tragedy. It rose like a storm and swept the whole world. The victorious Tatars made their entry into the capital city of Baghdad in 650 AH and turned it into a mass of rubble. Ibn Kathir gave the following account of the sacking of Baghdad. Death and destruction reigned supreme in Baghdad for 40 days, after which this most beautiful city of the world was left crushed and ruined to the extent that only a handful of people could be seen in it. Dead bodies were piled in the streets in heaps as high as a ridge. It rained and the corpses decomposed. Their stench filled the air, and the epidemic that broke out after it spread as far as Syria, taking a very heavy toll on life, wherever it went. Famine and death stalked the land. The Egyptians pushed back the Tartars. When they had overrun Iraq and Syria, the Tartars turned their attention towards Egypt. The Egyptian Sultan, Saifuddin Qataz, decided that attack was the best form of defense, and instead of waiting for the Tartars to arrive, he took the initiative and marched against them with a large army. A tremendous battle took place at Anjaluf, in which, contrary to past experience, the Tartars were defeated. After the death of Saifuddin, the good work was continued by his successor, Babers, who completely shattered the myth of the invincibility of the Tartars by inflicting successive defeats upon them until the whole of Syria was again in the hands of the Muslims. The conquerors of Muslims became captives of Islam. However, the Tartars still rule over the vast stretch of Islamic territory from Iraq to Iran. The seat of the Islamic Caliphate, that is Baghdad, was in their hands. It was a cruel irony that such uncultivated race should be in possession of the nerve center of the Islamic Empire. It affected the entire intellectual and cultural life of the Muslims, but they could do nothing about it. They were powerless. Now, when all seemed lost, the spiritual power of Islam came to the fore to accomplish a wonderful miracle of conquest. A few unknown and sincere Muslim preachers, courtiers, commenced the work of propagation of Islam amongst the ruling circles of the Tartars, and Islam's magic did the rest. The conquerors of the Muslim became the captives of Islam. Writing about this glorious event, Ibn Kathir says, "In this year, 694 AH, Qazan, the great grandson of Genghis Khan, sat on the throne and embraced Islam publicly at the hand of Amir Tawzun. May the blessings of Allah be upon his soul. With him, nearly all the Tartars became Muslims. Gold, silver, and pearls were given away in charity on the day of the Sultan's conversion. The Sultan adopted Mahmud as his Muslim name and attended the congressional Friday prayers. Many temples were demolished. Jizya was imposed. Confiscated properties were restored in Baghdad and other people and other places to their rightful owners, and justice was dispensed. People saw rosaries in the hands of the Tartars and exalted the bountilessness and the glory of God." The impact of the Tartar invasion on the Muslim world. The Muslim world suffered a grave setback as a result of the Tartar invasion. Its intellectual progress was arrested, and the general feeling of pessimism was created amongst the Muslims about the future of Islam. Overwhelmed by it, the ulama and the Muslim intellectuals closed the door of ijtihad. Stagnation crept over them, and they believed that the safety of Islam lay in rigidly containing everything in its existing state. It was succeedingly unfortunate for the stewardship of the world to have passed into the hands of people who had just stepped out of a barbaric condition. Though the conversion of the Tartars had made it possible for the Muslims to live in peace and had reinstated Islam as the religion of the empire, the Tartars were greatly lacking in the qualities of Islamic imamah. It would have taken those qualities a long time to develop in them, and the Islamic world in such circumstances could ill afford to wait. What the Muslims urgently needed was an ardent and an energetic nation which could instill a new life into them and discharge the functions of their leadership with the dedication of an inspired people. the advent of the Ottoman Turks. Within a short time in the 15th century, the Ottoman Turks made their debut on the stage of history. They shot to the notice of the world in 455 AD when the 24-year-old Sultan Muhammad the Conqueror took Constantinople, the impregnable capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. This victory, which had eluded the Muslims for 800 years in spite of repeated attempts, thrilled the entire Muslim world and revived its spirits. The Muslims felt they could pin their hopes on the Ottoman Turks as potential leaders of the Muslim revival. They could be trusted with the leadership of the Islamic world. They had sufficient endurance, foresight, and strength, and had given ample proof of their ability in the pursuit of their ideals. Baron Kara, the Vox, rightly observed in the following words. The victory of Muhammad the Conqueror was not a gift of fortune or a result of Eastern Empire having grown weak. The Sultan had been preparing for it for a long time. He had taken advantage of all the existing scientific knowledge. The cannons had just been invented, and he decided to equip himself with the biggest cannon in the world, and for this he acquired the services of a Hungarian engineer who constructed a cannon that could fire a ball weighing 300 kilograms at a distance of 1 mile. It is said that this cannon was pulled by 700 men, and it took 2 hours to be loaded. Muhammad marched on to Constantinople with 300,000 soldiers and a strong artillery. His fleet, which besieged the city from the sea, consisted of 120 warships. By the great ingenuity, the Sultan resolved to send a part of his fleet by land. He launched 70 ships into the sea from the direction of Qasim Pasha by carrying them over wooden boards upon which fat had been applied to make them slippery. The Sultan had struck so much fear into the heart of Europe that when he died, the Pope ordered continuous thanksgiving for 3 days across the Christian Empire. Advantages enjoyed by the Ottoman Turks. The Ottomans enjoyed a number of advantages which destined them to the leadership of the Muslim world. 1. They were a vigorous, big-hearted, enterprising race, charged with a crusading zeal. Used to a nomadic existence, they were free from being lazy and voluptuous habits that had been the ruins of the Eastern Muslims. 2. They possessed great military strength and could be relied upon to safeguard the spiritual and temporal interests of Islam and defend the Muslim world against its enemies. Their rule extended over 3 continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa. The Muslim world from Iran to Morocco was in their possession. Asia Minor they had subjected, and in Europe they had advanced as far as the walls of Vienna. They were the masters of the Mediterranean Sea. A trusted friend of Peter the Great wrote to him from Constantinople saying that the Ottoman sultans regarded the Black Sea as a private lake in which they allowed no foreigners. The Turkish navy was so powerful that the combined maritime strength of Europe could not compete. In 1547 AD, the combined fleets of Rome, Venice, Spain, Portugal, and Malta were badly beaten. During the reign of Suleiman the Great, the Ottoman Empire stretched over an area of 400,000 square miles from the river Sava in the north to the mouth of the Nile in the south, and from the Caucasus in the east to the Mount Atlas in Morocco in the west. Every important city of the ancient world, with the exception of Rome, was included. The Ottoman fleet consisted of 3,000 ships. Many Christian monarchs sought the favors of the Ottoman sultans, and even church bells would be silenced as a mark of respect. The Ottomans occupied a place of vital strategic importance on the world map. Their capital, Istanbul, which was Constantinople earlier, was unrivaled in its geographical and strategic situation. It stood at the meeting point of Europe and Asia, from where the Ottomans could control all 3 continents of the old world. It is said by Napoleon at a later date that if the world government was ever established, Constantinople would be the capital. The Ottomans were established in Europe, which was to acquire great importance in the near future and was already beginning to throb with a new life. They had the glorious opportunity of stealing a march on Christian Europe in heralding a new age and guiding the world along the path of enlightened progress that Islam had chalked out for it. Before Europe emerged to lead it to its doom. The decline of the Ottoman Turks. but to the misfortune and the misfortune of the entire Islamic world. The Turks surrendered to the temptations of ease and luxury. Their morals deteriorated and their rulers became tyrannical. Internal feuds and dissensions began, and provisional governors and the army generals became corrupt and disloyal. The greatest error the Ottomans made was that they allowed their minds to become static. In the sphere of warfare and military organization, they utterly ignored divine injunctions reproduced earlier, enjoining them to preserve their strength to the utmost in order to strike terror in the hearts of the enemies. Slowly, they allowed their magnificent fighting machine to rust and decay. Again, the advice of the Prophet ﷺ was, wisdom is not the lost property of a Muslim. Wherever he finds it, it is his. Wisdom is the lost property of a Muslim. Wherever he finds it, it is his. Fail to influence them. Past as they were in the midst of a hostile nations of Europe, it was expected that they would permanently keep before them the wise advice Amr ibn As had given to the Egyptians. Do not forget that you are eternally in danger. You are standing at an outpost of vital importance. Therefore, be always vigilant and ready with your arms. You are surrounded by enemies whose covetous eyes are on you and your country. But the Ottomans became complacent while the European nations started to make rapid progress. The Ottomans remained at a standstill. As the well-known Turkish scholar Halid Edib says in her book, Conflict of East and Western Turkey, as long as the world remains scholastic, the Muslim religious body did its duty admirably, and the Suleiman and the Fatih Madarse were the centers of learning and whatever science was at that point of time. But when the West broke the chains of scholasticism and created a new learning and science, the effects of which were to change the face of the world, the Muslim religious body failed very badly in its educational function. The ulama took it for granted that human knowledge had not grown beyond that it was in the 13th century, and the attitude of mind persisted in their educational system down to the middle of the last century. The complacence of the ulama in Turkey, particularly, and in the Muslim world generally, had nothing to do with their loyalty to the teachings of Islam, for the scholastic philosophy and theology, Christian or Muslim, is Hellenic. It is more or less Aristotelian, the teaching of Greek, a pagan philosopher, and for this reason, a brief comparative review of Islamic and Christian teachings seems necessary over here. The Quran does not set out to explain the creation of material universe in detail. It emphasizes much more the moral and social side of human life. It is concerned with husn and khub, that is, the beauty and the ugly, which has nothing more than good and evil, hence its law. Nor is the metaphysical and the spiritual side of Islam all that complicated. It is based on the recognition of unity, a single creative force of one Allah. Hence, the simplicity of Islam and the comparative freedom of Muslims to accept the new interpretations of the material world. But this admirable simplicity and open-mindedness, which could accommodate new knowledge of matter, did not last long amongst the Muslims. In the 9th century, not only Islamic law but also theology was definitely put into rigid frames by the great Muslim thinkers. The philosophy of Aristotle was incorporated in the new Muslim theology, and the doors of Ijtihad were completely closed. Now, Christian doctrine, which is the teachings of St. Paul and the Church Fathers rather than that of Jesus Christ, contains a detailed explanation of the material universe. This has been accepted as the revelation, and its truth had been accounted for. As Christian theologians could not prove anything by observation, they tried to do so by reasoning. They had to recourse to Aristotle for the reasons that he is almost a magician in his logical capacity. When the West began to study nature by observation, by analysis and experiment, the Christian church was shocked. When the analytical methods led to great discoveries, the Christians throughout the church thought that meant that the end of its authority. Hence, in the West, we behold an age of suffering and martyrdom for the scientists and the honest seekers after the truth about material world. After a bloody conflict between science and Christianity, the Christian church took up a realistic attitude, and scientific knowledge was gradually incorporated in the instructions given in the colleges as well as primary schools. The universities, which were like the madrasa of the ulama, evolved into centers of new learning and science without losing their hold over theology and metaphysics. The consequence was that the Christian church preserved its authority over some sections, at least, of the intelligentsia. The Catholic and the Protestant priests could discuss problems of every kind with the new youth and could be reckoned among the scientifically educated elite. The position of the Ottoman ulama was different. They never pursued new learning or new truth about matter. But in the first place, there was nothing in the way of new thought to persecute. As long as they were the supreme educators of the Muslim nation, nothing new could infiltrate. They saw that, and their learning stagnated. Further, during the age of decline, they were so occupied with politics that it seemed by far the easiest thing to stick to Aristotle, to reasoning on the basis of knowledge, rather than venture on observation and analysis. Therefore, the madrasa remained until the end of the last century that they were in the 13th century. The waqf, or the mosque schools, which were the sole organization for primary education, remained singularly unchanged. Intellectual sterility throughout the Muslim world. Intellectual sterility and the inefficiency of the education system were not peculiar to the Turkish life, but were common across the Muslim world. The Muslims universally had grown inert both mentally and spiritually. If we do not, for the sake of caution, trace their stupor back to the 14th century, the 15th century was definitely the last to reveal any real intellectual life amongst the followers of Islam. It was during this century that Ibn Khaldun wrote his prominent book. In the 16th century, indolence of mind, slavish pedantry, blind imitation became complete. One does not find even one in 100 amongst the ulama of the last four centuries who may with justice be called a genius or may have produced anything to set beside the bold and noble intellectual activities of the earlier centuries. Only a few were above the low intellectual level of their age, and incidentally they all came from India. One of the eminent personalities was Sheikh Ahmad Sirhindi, Mujaddid al-Fasani, 17th century, who left a lasting impression on the whole Muslim world. His letters made a valuable contribution to Islamic religious thought. Another prominent figure was Shah Waliullah Dehlavi. His Hujjatullah al-Baligha and other works were unique in their particular fields. The third prominent person was his son, Shah Rafiuddin Dehlavi, who in the 19th century wrote two significant books. Also outstanding was Shah Ismail Shahid, whose Mansab-e-Imamat remains to this day work of great scholars. Similarly, the ulama of Farangi Mahal and some of the educational centers of eastern areas were worthy of note for their high degree of learning and scholarship, did much to improve the educational standards of their time, but their talents were confined largely to scholastics, and only the exception of Shah Waliullah, who wrote on ethics, politics, economics, history, and sociology. Excessive conservatism and servility of tradition also robbed poetry and literature of its freshness. Language became heavy with embellishments. Even the personal letter, official notes, and memorandum were not free from this defect. The madrasa and other institutions of learnings were afflicted with the inferiority complex, which degraded literature. Classics were gradually expelled from the syllabus, and their place was taken by compilations of latter-day writers who lacked originality of thought and were merely blind imitators or interpreters of the old masters. Classical texts written by early scholars were placed by annotations and commentaries, in the compilation of which authors practiced extreme economy and reduced them to mere notes. Eastern contemporary of the Turks. Along with the Ottoman Empire, there were two important Muslim empires in the East. One was the Mughal Empire of India. Founded in 1526 by Babur, it was the rare good fortune to be ruled one after another by a number of wise and powerful emperors, the last of whom was Aurangzeb, who will always be remembered in the history of Islam in India for the purity of his personal character, religious ardor, and wide conquests. He ruled for about half a century. After his death in the first half of the 18th century, the Mughal Empire declined and his successors proved weak, inefficient, and utterly unworthy. Simultaneously, it was the time of Europe's resurgence, not to speak of protecting the world of Islam against the hostile intentions of the West. The Mughals could not save their own empire from falling prey to the onslaught of the West, and became, on account of their weakness and incapability, the stepping stone of England's boundless prosperity and enslavement of the Muslim world. The other was the Safavid Empire of Iran. In its earlier days, it was a very enlightened and progressive state, but exaggerated Shiaism and senseless quarreling with Turkey sapped its energy and rendered it ineffective. Both these empires isolated themselves completely from the outside world. They lost touch with time and shut their eyes to the numerous changes that were taking place around them. Europe was a far cry, and even the developments in adjoining Muslim countries did not excite any interest. Individual efforts. The ability of Islam to sustain itself when everything appears to have conspired against it runs through the whole course of history. In various Muslim lands, there arose men of strength and vision who tried to reverse the process of history. In India, the lion-hearted Tipu Sultan made a historic attempt to win back his country from the foreigners. A little later, Sayyid Ahmad Shahid dreamt of founding a state extending from Boracá on the lines of Khulafa'i Rashidun. He encouraged thousands of earnest and noble-minded preachers and fighters who, through their religious enthusiasm, sincerity, and selflessness, revived the memories of the first centuries of Islam. But collective denigration had become too extensive that individual exertions could not arrest the march of decay. Europe's scientific and industrial progress. Europe, meanwhile, was making colossal scientific and industrial progress. Europeans were conquering hidden forces of matter, unveiling the new secrets of nature, and discovering unknown lands. During the 16th and the 17th century, Europe produced a large number of outstanding men in all fields of creative activity. Scientists, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, revolutionized the world of physics, while Columbus, Vasco da Gama, Magellan discovered the New World and many other lands and sea routes. The destiny of mankind was being recast in the West, and the world was changing at a breathtaking pace. He who lost a moment in idleness lost a great deal. The Muslims, alas, neglected not only minutes, but centuries. Wherever the European nations realized the value of time and covered the distance of centuries in years, the Turks lagged so far behind in the field of industry that shipbuilding had not started until the 16th century. The printing press, health services, and defense academies were introduced in Turkey only in the 17th century. Towards the end of the 18th century, when the balloon was sent flying over Constantinople, the Turks thought that it was a magic trick. With the imperial Turkey lagging so far behind, what could have been the plight of Muslim countries that were under its sovereignty? They did not possess even minor industries. A French traveler who traveled in Egypt in the 18th century and stayed for 4 years in Syria wrote that this country, Syria, is so backward in the matter of industry that if your watch goes wrong here, you will have to go to a foreigner to get it mended. In their heyday, the Turks were unmatched in the world for military proficiency, but now, even in this area, the Europeans had surpassed them. In 1774, the Ottoman Empire suffered a crushing defeat in the hands of Europe. The shock of this defeat helped somewhat to open the eyes of the Turks to the ugly reality of their situation, and some efforts were made by them to improve things. Military reorganization was taken with the help of foreign experts. The real work of national reconstruction was, however, undertaken by Sultan Salim III, who had incidentally been brought up outside the palace. He opened new fashion schools, including engineering college, in which he himself taught. He laid the nucleus of a modern army called the New Order and introduced political reforms. But stagnation had so firmly entrenched in Turkey that before any substantial headway could be made, the old army rebelled against the Sultan and he was slain. After him, Mahmud II and his successor, Abdul Majid I, devoted themselves to the task of nation building, and the country took some steps towards forward during his reign. But these few attempts at reconstruction were nothing compared to the mighty strides of Europe. The fate that befell the Muslims in Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, India, Turkestan, and elsewhere in the 18th and 19th century could easily have been predicted in the 16th and the 17th century. Jazakallahu khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.